You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's worldview segment, we're going to talk about adoption. And actually, we're going to carry this over onto several worldview segments. So we'll just simply label it Adoption Part 1. And for today, what we're talking about really is why adoption. And I'm here with Monica. And obviously, we have adopted four children. We did it through two different processes. One HEG, one non-HEG, and we'll get into some of those details later, although this is not going to be a class on adoption per se, but we do want to share our experiences with you with regards to adoption. So, Monica, why adoption?
Well, I think for me, one of the things that's always been on my heart was I felt like God wanted me to have a larger family, and we were only able to have three. That was a big draw for me. The other was I knew that there were children out there that needed a home, that needed a mom and a dad and a family to be able to call their own and not to be orphaned and alone and by themselves forever.
Yeah, those are absolutely reasons why specifically Christians adopt. And, you know, we are called to look out for the fatherless because God obviously does care about the fatherless very much.
Yes.
It's mentioned throughout Scripture. And there is a, I think those are totally legitimate reasons to adopt. But there's also this grander purpose and reason.
I agree. That grand reason is really awesome. I know that that's been your primary reason for adoption, and I admire that.
Right. So orphan care is more than just adoption. Really what it is about grace. And what we see is from Christ's redemptive work on the cross, he reconciles us. And before the foundations of the world, God had chosen, for whatever reason, his elect.
Yes.
And he really, what he does is not just save them, but he also adopts them into his family,
yeah,
become part of the family of God.
Yeah.
So people go from being children of wrath to children of God. And so then we, as Christians, we emulate God, albeit very imperfectly, through adoption.
Yeah, it is a beautiful picture, and it's something that I, on a daily basis, try to remind myself of, to dying to self and remembering that it's because of God, because he loved us, because he adopted us, that we are able to even love others or even love him.
Yeah. Ephesians 1:5 says, he predestined us for adoption as sons through Jesus Christ according to the purpose of his will. And one of the things that, you know, we read a book, it's called Orphanology,
mm-hmm,
that to help us to understand, you know, what we were doing, why we were doing it, you know, just helped us to kind of work through these issues as we were getting ready to start the process.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they emphasized in that book, which is a great book if you are thinking about adopting, you should read it. And it's this doctrine of imago Deo. Okay, so imago Deo means in the image of God. And so that's how we look at people. Because we are made in the image of God, imago Deo, all humans have inherent worth, value, dignity. So it goes in how we should look at the fatherless, how we should look at the elderly,
yeah,
how we should look at the unborn. All of these tie together.
Yeah.
So an adoption is just really an extension of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, and for me, I think one of the things that's been kind of exciting as, you know, we've adjusted to being a larger family and having more kids is that these children, none of them, it doesn't matter whether they were born into the family or adopted into the family, accidentally got here. All of them came here deliberately through the hand of God, and that this was something that he had planned from long before we were even created for all these children to be Mitzels.
That's right. So with all of these reasons, for adoption. Again, it is the looking out for the fatherless. It is growing the family. Yeah. And that reminds me of Genesis 1:28, the cultural mandate, and it reminds me of Matthew 28:19, the Great Commission.
Yeah.
All of these are fulfilled in adoption.
Yeah. Well, definitely, as we expand our families, whether through birth or adoption, you know, we're sharing the gospel and we're raising the children sure. up to be soldiers of Christ and to be people who, you know, are sharing the gospel with others, and we're expanding His kingdom.
That's right. So I think for today, we've quickly hit on the reasons why adoption. I'll just leave you with this, and that's James 1:27, and it says, "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world."
Amen.
On today's podcast, I want to talk to you about the Great Hunt of 2014. Now, I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek because there really wasn't anything great about it. Other than the bottom line is that I've got venison hanging in my garage right now. We hope to get somewhere between 60 and 80 pounds of meat off of this young buck, and that is a great thing. But how I got there was another story, and it's quite comical. So that's what I want to share with you today, along with a few things that I found on my property along the way, and maybe a couple of tips. So that's what we're going to discuss today, is the Great Hunt of 2014. Now, I am absolutely no expert. In fact, in most of the topics that I bring to you on this podcast, I'm not an expert in. But what I'm trying to do is to help you learn as I learn. So as I learn these things, I'm sharing it with you in the hopes that you can minimize some of the mistakes that I have made and hopefully gain some knowledge from it. And so I am not an expert specifically in deer hunting. I have very little experience, in fact. And up to this point in my life, my hunting has been small game and javelina, and now a bit of deer hunting. So I've really been looking forward to this, and I'm definitely going to expand upon it. I really like it. So one of the things I want to talk about today is why hunt? Why would somebody hunt? Now, a lot of people will say, hey, I hunt for the meat. And that's a completely legitimate reason. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I want to hunt, is for the meat. But we have to also be honest with ourselves, because the reality is that when you put together the whole package on hunting, if you were honest with yourselves, if you took the money that it costs you to buy the rifle, buy the ammunition, practice, buy all of your mossy oak camouflage, buy all of the scent reduction stuff and all those things, if you think about scouting out hunting areas and maybe even laying in food plots and salt licks and all these kinds of things that people do, if we're honest with ourselves, when it really comes down to it, that's not the cheapest way to put meat on the table. Now, in the long run, maybe, you know, if you're not buying a bunch of Gucci gear every year, if you're not using it to justify buying rifle after rifle after rifle, then maybe it is economical to put meat on the table through hunting. So I'm all about that, and I hope that I can stay true to that, and that I can put meat on the table in an economical way. And so you have to watch all those other things, all the little gadgets and clothing and those kinds of things, if that's your goal. But that can't be the only reason, is what I'm saying. It's a perfectly good reason, and I think that anybody who hunts should use the meat. I mean, if you're hunting just for the sport alone, you know, honestly, I don't see any value in that. I don't respect that to be honest with you. I think you should use the animal. Okay, so the meat of the deer, for example, is something that we should use. So there's got to be something more than just the meat. I think it is a number of things. It's the history. I mean, it's the, you know, our forefathers did need to use venison and things like that just for survival. And so they were able to live off hunting, at least for a portion of their subsistence. Now, if you only rely on hunting, man, you're taking a serious gamble. So I think it can be part of a plan. It shouldn't be your only plan. And if your preparedness plan is like, if things all fall apart, I'm going to go into the woods and hunt, man, you're really not in a good position. Okay. But it is, as a part of a plan, I think it's a good thing. So it's that there's a historical tie to hunting deer. There's also a management aspect. There's a lot of places where the deer are out of control. And so hunting is a way of managing animals. Okay, that's why states give out so many tags every year, and they manage it based on the species, whether it's whitetail or mule deer or moose or bear or whatever. Okay, so that there's a management aspect to it. You're participating in that. There's also that skill of being able to hunt. So all these things work together, I think, that make hunting a good thing and a skill that people should achieve. And it's quite satisfying. So that's why I hunt. So I do hunt for the meat, but to be honest with you, it would be cheaper for me to do something like, if I'm just trying to raise protein, it would be cheaper for me to do aquaponics. It would be cheaper for me to raise chickens. It would be cheaper for me to buy a calf, raise it, slaughter it myself. That would probably be cheaper. Okay, but all of these things have their place, and hunting is certainly one of them, and something I cherish. I certainly don't take it lightly as well. Okay, so how to hunt deer. Well, this is a huge topic, and my point today is not to go into a bunch of detail. I'm just telling you my story. But there's where to hunt, whether it's public lands or private lands, and how best to find those, and hunting leases, and there's when to hunt. There's what time of the day, and then there's all the phases of deer season. There's pre-rut and rut, post-rut. And there's different gear for hunting, and that's all, you know, there's your rifle and ammunition, and whether you're bow hunting or using muzzle loaders and all those kinds of things, and tree stands and game carts, and whether you can take motorized vehicles, all those aspects. There's the fundamentals of hunting. So a lot of people are scouting out areas before. They're establishing food plots if they have hunting lands. There's people that are baiting, depending on whether it's legal in your area or not. And, of course, there's all these different hunting strategies. People will sight and stalk, or they'll use tree stands, or they'll use ground blinds or elevated blinds. All of this, and all the way down to, you know, shot placement and then trailing strategies on how to do that, whether you immediately start trailing or you wait a time, hoping that the deer wanders off and goes down very close to where you shot it. Okay, so there's all those things to think through and to learn if you are not experienced hunting, or even if you have a lot of experience on how to improve your hunting. So my story is this. I got my tag. In fact, we got two tags for our family, one for me, one for my daughter, who will be next, but we're going to wait on that until we process the deer that's hanging in our garage, because we've only got one spot for it. So we got our tags on a Sunday, and on Monday, I decided, hey, you know, let's I'm going to take my son and we're just going to go around our property. We're going to go hunting. Now, what was I super prepared and had this intense strategy? No, not really. To be honest with you, my intent was to scout out the property, which, by the way, we see deer here all the time. So I know there's deer around here. They, quite frankly, are used to human scent. And so that, I think, is a huge advantage for hunting on your own land. But anyway, so we decided we're going to walk around the property. And again, we have 40 acres. So it's not huge when it comes to hunting, but it's plenty. It's plenty to walk around for hours, for sure. And so we decided to do that. I took my son and I just explained to him we're going to go and look at the property. And so one of the things was to scout out areas, look for deer trails, which there are deer trails all over this place, look for sign, which there's sign all over this place, but just kind of take a look. And we also brought a 22 as well for small game. So we have snowshoe hare on our property. And so if we saw a hare, we were going to take a hare. We did not see a hare. And so we decided to head out and check out some of those areas where deer trails are, where deer like to browse, and things like that. So we took off and we started walking on the property. And I'm just observing the area. We're stopping every few minutes and listening. We did not take all kinds of precautions when it comes to scent. And because, again, I wasn't exactly planning on bagging a deer. It was more about looking around, getting to know the property. But I still don't know it fully. I know the basic boundaries. I know I've walked it. But there's lots of nooks and crannies that I haven't seen yet. So that was an objective. So we're walking around the property, stopping every a couple minutes and just listening. You know, so we'd stop for 5 minutes and just look and listen. Saw all kinds of wildlife, squirrels and birds and things like that. And then we came upon an area on the western side of our property, which is in, there's stands of cedar up there. We've got some pretty good cedar growing amongst a bunch of pines and firs. So we have lodgepole pine and ponderosa pine and western white pine, and we have grand fir and Douglas fir, and then we have some cedar and some hemlock as well. There's a few hardwoods in there, but that's the main portions of our property. So I was getting a chance to see that, see the different mature stands versus the young seedlings and the different stages of forest succession. So that was cool. And we came across these woodpeckers. There was a pair of pileated woodpeckers was hanging out there. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about pileated woodpeckers. They don't migrate. They stay in one area, so they have a territory. And obviously they burrow into snags, which is basically a dead tree stand, even fallen logs. And that's where they use to get their main food, which is different types of insects, specifically carpenter ants. So let me help you out with some identification of a pileated woodpecker. Listen to this. Yes. Pileated woodpecker is none other than Woody Woodpecker and his bride. He lives in our backyard. It's very cool. A strikingly beautiful animal. These birds, forest birds, they're large. They're nearly the size of like a large black crow. So think of a large black crow, and there you have these huge woodpeckers. They got these bold white stripes down the neck and that flaming red crest that Woody Woodpecker makes us all think about. And I know many of you recognize that cartoon, and maybe it's not so much the kids of today. They like to whack at dead trees, fallen logs, like I said, in search of their food. and they nest in these holes. They have these very distinctive rectangular holes that they build. So if you see those, you know that you have these woodpeckers. Now they're very prominent on the eastern portion of the United States, and on the west coast in the Olympic Mountains, and then also in the Rocky Mountains. But other than that, you're really not going to find a lot of them. So like I said, in those areas, they're pretty prominent. We've got a pair of them on our property here. Very cool. They dig those rectangular holes to find ants, and they excavate homes and will defend their territory. And like I said, they don't migrate. They stay, and they have their specific territory, and they usually stay with their mate. They prefer large trees. They could be coniferous or deciduous or mixed. They like tall western hemlock stands, a beech, and when I saw them up there, they were messing around in cedar mostly. So obviously they don't mind that either. In addition to ants, which is probably the bulk of their food, they'll eat wild fruits, nuts. They'll eat blackberries. In addition to that, they'll take other insects, so flies and larvae, termites, all kinds of insects like that. So they're very useful as well to a forest. So I mean, you know, they may do some damage, but like I said, most of the time they're picking the trees that are already dead for nesting. So they'll take snags. So that's one consideration. People tend to like to leave a few snags in their forest for the habitat, because they're awesome looking birds, but they also help take care of the forest too. So they're working for you 24 hours a day. So I like my pileated woodpeckers and will continue to leave them alone. So they're a great addition to the forest and the habitat around here. Really cool to look at. So we passed along away from the pileated woodpeckers. They flew away and I'm sure came right back as soon as we left, stayed out of their area. So we were continuing to stalk, move around the property nice and slow, taking a look at all the different areas. Didn't see any deer. And about an hour and a half into it, we're moving very slowly through a stand of pine, different pine trees, and I stopped because, again, I was about maybe 50 feet away from this large blackish-type thing in the shadows. And one of the things, if you've ever studied camouflage and how to find things, and I learned this going through a man-tracking course many, many years ago. That applied this very much into my search and rescue experience. When you're looking for something in the woods, don't look for what it is that your brain is looking to see. So, for example, when you look for a white-tailed deer in the woods, don't look for a white-tailed deer. Look for movement. Look for something that's out of the ordinary. You know, you're not, if you, because our the way our brains work, it wants to see that picture, that perfect picture of that white-tailed deer. And oftentimes, if that's what you think you're looking for, you're not going to find it. It's the same thing in search and rescue. If you're looking for, say, a child in the woods, don't look for the picture of that child that everybody is handing around. Look for a disturbance. Look for something out of the ordinary. Look for a little flash of color. Look for movement. That's what you're looking for, something that's out of the ordinary. Same thing with looking for tracks, animal tracks. Don't look for that picture-perfect track of that animal. Look for disturbance. Look for something that's partial, that's out of the ordinary. That's how you search. And so something caught my eye. I saw something that was just a little out of the ordinary. We were about 50 feet away from a cow moose, a gigantic moose. The moose, or Eurasian elk, as they call it in Europe, it's the largest species in the deer family. They are huge. This female that I came across was probably somewhere between 600 and 800 pounds. She was massive, but she just stayed there, sat on, lay. You know, she was laying down on the ground, and just watched me. And so we gave her a wide berth and kept moving. Now, in North America, you'll find moose, especially in the Rocky Mountain region. So here in Idaho, they're prevalent. But the moose populations of North America have been in steep decline since around the 1990s. Now, so management has been a big deal with moose. So as far as protections and things, now you can hunt moose, but it is much more restrictive, and so it's more of a lottery process. The amount of tags that are given out are much fewer. There's both antlered and antlerless hunting seasons, and in certain areas, so it's managed well. And for Idaho specifically, it's a once in a lifetime thing to be able to hunt an antlered or antlerless, to bag an antlered and antlerless moose. Except for things that they have other ways you can do it via a super hunt, another extra lottery process, or any out of state resident tags that go unsold, you're allowed to purchase those as well, but managed closely. On the conservation status scale, and the scale goes all the way from extinct in the wild, critically endangered, vulnerable, near threatened, and least concern. And moose are of the least concern category, but like I said, tightly managed. Moose are herbivores, and they are capable of consuming many different types of plants and fruits. They eat up to about 10,000 calories a day, or about 70 pounds of forage. So they eat a lot of vegetation, non-grasses, forbs, fresh shoots from trees, from willow, birch, aspen. We definitely have birch and aspen on our property. And an adult moose, male, stands about 6 feet tall at their shoulder, and they can weigh up to, this is males, 840 to 1,540 pounds. And females, or cows, generally will be between 440 and over 1,000 pounds. So they're just massive animals. Beautiful, massive, not to be messed with. I keep seeing these videos out there of specifically the snowmobilers, kind of like egging them on or chasing them down trails, and then these cows or bulls turn around and destroy the sleds. So don't mess with moose. They're diurnal, which means they're active during the day and they sleep at night. There's a strong bond between mother and calf, and we'll see that here. We see a cow and a calf booming around together. Generally won't see them with the bulls. Bulls are polygamous, so they seek several females to breed with, and they'll fight for that. The female moose has an 8-month gestation period, and usually bearing one calf or maybe twins. And generally speaking, the calves will stay with the mother until just before the next young are born. So they'll stay for about a year. And, again, they can be very aggressive, so they're not to be messed with. We generally steer clear of them. And like I said, when we came up on this cow, we were, no kidding, about 50 feet away. So we just gave her a wide berth. I don't have a moose tag, so I wasn't going to shoot her. So we carried on. The next portion of the great hunt was my introduction to a microcosm of frost heaving. So frost heaving is an upward swelling of soil during freezing conditions caused by an increasing presence of ice. And it's kind of a capillary action. So this freezing front gets into these capillaries and the ice gets down in there, freezes, and then it kind of swells. So certain soils will swell. And then as many of you are probably aware, then you can step down and you'll kind of sink down. Maybe it's a couple inches or 6 inches or a foot. Now, frost heaving on a larger scale can do massive damage to pavement, to foundations. It forms potholes in roads, especially, you know, some of your dirt roads, and a lot of damage. In this case, we had this little frost heaving. We were on a deer trail walking through, and then I stepped through a little, probably 6 inches, and completely rolled my ankle. And I sprained it pretty good. So fortunately, I didn't yell out. It hurt, but I didn't yell out because we were in observation mode, hoping to see some more wildlife. But I had to sit there for a minute or two, tighten up my boot, recovered, and then kept moving just for a little while. So we kept going. I've got this rolled ankle that I know is swelling in there, so that's why I really tightened up that boot to keep it nice and tight, keep the swelling down, and moving along. So we continue to go on our little route and decide, quite frankly, because I know I need to get some ice on this thing, okay, I need to go ahead and call this and get back to the house. So there I am with my sprained ankle, making it back to the house. Get inside my nice warm house, sitting by my wonderful fireplace, drinking some hot tea. I've got an ice pack on my ankle. It's, you know, keeping the swelling down. I've got a pretty good sprain. So I'm sitting there. I'm in my socks. I've still got, you know, some pants on and my shirt. And then my daughter yells, says, "Dad, there's a deer in the backyard." And we have a pasture out behind our house. It's not a big pasture, and then it's surrounded by forest. But it's a sloping pasture, and at the bottom of it where it's fenced in, this is an area where there's deer trails that go through. And so occasionally we'll see deer down in there. And she's like, "There's a deer in the backyard." And so I jump up, grab my rifle, go out on the back deck. I see this real young buck just feeding outside of it, browsing outside of our little pasture, kind of moving along the fence. And it's about maybe 125 meters, so it's not very far. So as the deer is moving along, I sight in with my rifle, and I shoot the deer. So all that 2 hours of hunting, walking around, culminating in the sprained ankle, bringing me back to the house. And lo and behold, as soon as I relax and sit down in my easy chair, a deer shows up in our backyard. I shoot the deer. And at this point, I know that I'm not in great shape, but I know we've got some uneven terrain. We've got to move down. It's not flat by any means. It's sloped. Not significant slope, but, you know, not easy walking either. So I think, okay, I'm going to have to track this deer. Let me just take my time. We got dressed, and my kids are very excited, and they want to go with me. And I think, okay, I'm probably going to have to track this deer at least for, you know, 100 meters, a couple hundred meters. I felt like I got a good shot. It was a close distance. Like I said, 125 meters. I had just zeroed the rifle, so I was very confident. And sure enough, by the time we got down there, the deer made it about 50, maybe 100 feet. So not very far at all. And it was sitting right there for us. But again, like I said, moving down there, I'm limping down there with my kids. We field dress the deer. And we, you know, we've got to carry it up to the house about 150 meters at this point down where it is in particular. I don't have any way to get a utility vehicle down there right now, where I didn't have a utility vehicle on Monday, picked it up on Wednesday. So I could have had some help on Wednesday. But we field dressed it, got it all cleaned out down there. Messy job, by the way. I didn't do a very good job. It was my first deer, and so it was a little bit messy, but got the job done. Got it all cleaned out. So me and my kids, we carry this deer about 150 meters up to our garage. get it, got it all hung up, went ahead and skinned it that night, and now it's aging in our garage. Okay, so that is the Great Hunt of 2014. A couple of projects coming up that I want to mention just because they're related to this. It's tanning the hide. So we're gonna experiment and tan this hide of this this deer. And so we're going to work on that, or we are working on that. And so we'll keep you up to date on how that goes. What I'm going to do is on Facebook, after I publish this podcast, I'm going to go ahead and put a couple pictures online, pileated woodpeckers, moose, and our deer that's hanging. We, like I said, we hope to get somewhere between 60 and 80 pounds of meat, which would be awesome. Although, we'll see. So hopefully that's how it turns out. It might be a little less. But either way, that's a great end to this story. And then we'll also maybe cover the deboning, the butchering of the animal itself, and then maybe a couple of venison recipes with you coming up. So this concludes the Great Hunt of 2014.
Hi, this is Matron
and Maiden.
Journey with us
as we rediscover
the lost arts of womanhood. On today's episode of Matron and Maiden, we're going to talk about the benefits of cooking with cast iron. Mm-hmm. Now, I know for me personally, because my mom did not cook with cast iron, it wasn't something that I grew up with, I was a little intimidated by it because it seemed like it was high maintenance.
Yeah.
And it made a lot of things stick. I grew up, as soon as non-stick surfaces became available, that's what my mom bought. And that's what I've used for years. And as I've studied different things to cook with, I've realized that that's not a very healthy alternative. And that stuff can chip off.
Oh, yes. And then it gets into the food.
Yeah.
And
it's toxic.
Yeah.
It's just not good. So we're going to talk about cast iron and hopefully encourage you and inspire you to go out and buy your own set of cast iron and start experimenting with it. So some benefits, the first one would be that you can use less oil as you cook, as long as you've properly seasoned it and that you continue to properly maintain it.
Yeah.
Because it really doesn't stick.
Yes. And it's very simple to keep it nicely maintained.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally simple rules. As long as you follow those, you're fine. And the other is that it is chemical free, and so it replaces nonstick pans very effectively. But I think the most important benefit for probably most people is that it can actually increase the amount of iron that is in your food.
Yeah, that's why it's called a cast iron skillet.
Yeah, because the food draws the iron out from the pan as the heat allows it to penetrate, and it increases that. And, you know, according to a study done in 2007, and this is published in PubMed.gov, 2.4 million U.S. children are iron deficient. And this iron deficiency anemia is known to affect both behavioral and cognitive delays. So it's important to make sure that children have enough iron in their food. And if we can even do little things here and there to help increase the amount of iron, I would think that's important.
Yes. And this is very useful. Obviously, it won't completely solve the problem, but it will definitely help, and it probably maintains good iron once you get your iron up there, right?
Probably. I would imagine. I know a friend of mine who said that she had a problem with iron unless she was at her grandmother's house, who cooked with cast iron, and she stopped having problems with her anemia. So, and you know, women of childbearing age are particularly vulnerable to low iron. A study done by the CDC found that 9% of women ages 12 to 49 are iron deficient. And I would say this is true not only because I experienced it myself, but I've also known that as my daughters have gotten a little older, they've had problems with it occasionally as well. And those are the moments I say, okay, we need to increase a little bit more our meat or leafy greens,
yeah,
or cook more in the cast iron skillet. And some of the symptoms, you know, you might be surprised because it's things I think a lot of women experience, especially in the afternoon, but even sometimes in the morning, is general fatigue, you know, feeling like I just can't wake up, and especially if you need coffee. I think Lindy's nodding and saying yes, as she deals with that even now. Feeling weak, just kind of a generalized weakness, pale skin, which, you know, not everybody will even recognize that, especially if they go tanning or anything, because you've got some color. But a lot of times, you know, you notice that you don't have as much of a blush look in your cheeks, that you have kind of a paleness. Dizziness, and especially standing up too fast, that can be a really strong sign for low iron. Tingling or crawling feeling in your legs.
Yes.
And especially when you're laying in bed. It just kind of feels crawly on your legs. Cold hands and feet, brittle nails, and then, of course, headaches because you're, you know, getting lower oxygen to your brain. Now, like Lindy said, this isn't a cure. We're not pretending that somehow using a cast iron skillet is going to suddenly give you, you know, powerful iron levels in your body. But it can increase your iron, the iron content in your food by up to 20%. And one of the things they recommended was cooking things that are acidic. For instance, spaghetti sauce, which is one of our favorite things to make in the cast iron skillet.
Oh, yes, definitely.
I think it makes it taste better.
Yeah, it's almost like it has a...
I don't know.
A salty or irony taste.
I know. I don't.
And it tastes delicious.
Yeah. We've really, especially since we started using the cast iron skillet, have tried to only do our spaghetti sauce in the cast iron, except that we did last time use the pressure cooker.
Oh, yeah.
Just to test it out and see. Which, that combined the flavors really, really well. But it didn't have that deep
taste. Yeah, that's what I was missing. It was
a little
missing something.
Yeah.
And just, it didn't have it.
Yeah, so as the acidic foods help to draw the iron out even more. So that's something important to remember. Even if you only make spaghetti sauce once a week, try making it in your cast iron skillet or in a cast iron pot or whatever. So again, if you're iron deficient, this would just be something that you might want to consider. Also, there are foods out there that you can do instead of taking iron supplements, because those can cause constipation. They can cause additional problems if you're trying to supplement with iron. So increasing your meat, increasing beans, pumpkin seeds, like I said before, deep leafy greens, and then eggs can also help. And so cooking those in cast iron would make them even more iron-filled.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think we talked about, you know, these are good alternatives to nonstick as long as you are
seasoning it properly.
Yeah, seasoning it properly and then keeping it maintained properly.
Yeah. Speaking of seasoning, why do we have to season a pan?
Well, you season a pan to help it form a good layer so that when you cook food, it doesn't stick and it doesn't go all the way into the iron and the pan itself.
Oh. Because I thought seasoning was just for firewood.
Well, no, firewood needs to season too, but it's a different kind of seasoning. Ah. In this, we're going to prepare it using bacon fat, actually.
Mm.
But the first step is if you've received an old cast iron skillet, or maybe you found one at a garage sale or at a secondhand store, the first step is to make sure that it is totally clean. You'll want to scrub it. In this case, you can use soap and water, and this will be the only time that you're doing this.
Yes.
You will not use soap and water again with your cast iron skillet. So use soap and water, a scouring brush or a Brillo pad or something like that, and really get any rust or debris, anything, all off your pan. Using soap and hot water, and then again, rinse it really, really, really well. Okay. One option is to put it into a hot oven to make sure that it's completely dry. You don't want any water on there when you begin to season your pan. You don't even want the pan to be slightly damp because oil and water
reject each other.
Right, right. So the water will just keep the
oil out of the pan and keep the thing dry.
Yeah, so you don't want to do that. Now, once you've got it completely dry, you want to preheat your oven to around 350. Now, if you look this up on the internet, how to season a pan, which is exactly what I did when I got mine, there's all these different, some people do it at a lower oven for longer time. Some people do it at a higher for a shorter time. So it's really up to you, but I'm going to tell you what we do, and then you can decide on your own what you want to do. So we preheat the oven to 350. And now to season it, the best kind of fat to use is bacon fat.
That means we eat more bacon, right?
Right. No, we have bacon fat in the refrigerator. No more bacon. Mm. But it is a good reason to have bacon on a Saturday morning. Save your bacon fat.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can use it to season your cast iron skillet. It's a good fat to use to re-season it, too. So if it's starting to needing a little bit of re-seasoning, throw a couple of pieces on there and just cook it on a high heat on the stove. Mm. But anyway, you're going to rub the bacon fat all over the top and on the bottom and the outside over the whole entire cast iron skillet. And rub it in really, really well. And then you're going to place it upside down in the oven, making sure that you've got
like a cookie sheet or foil underneath it.
Right. Right. You want to have something because the fat will drip.
Yes.
And you don't want to start a fire or, like in the case of our kitchen,
smoke goes everywhere.
Well, smoke, and that makes the
fire alarms go off.
Yeah, the smoke alarms go off a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just not pleasant. So you're going to bake it in the oven now for 1 to 2 hours, and then turn the oven off and let it sit and let it cool on its own. Now, you want to repeat this.
Like 3 times, right?
Yeah, you can do it a total of 3 times, at least a total of 2 times. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But 3 times, I think, will season it the very best.
Yeah.
Now, honestly, after I do it the first time, I don't rub any fat on the outside anymore. I only do it on the inside. Yeah. I don't cook on the outside of my pan. So I don't figure I need it that much out there.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's nonstick to me on the outside. So, and this will be an all-day process to get it fully seasoned, or you can break it up into each day, but do not use it or wash it with water in between seasonings.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, if you want to break it up over a couple days because it does take a few hours, then that's fine. Just leave it set aside and, you know, and don't touch it. So as far as maintenance goes, this is something I've tried to teach my children because I don't want to have to scour and re-season and start all the way over.
Yeah. So what we do is we just wash it with only water.
Only water.
No soap whatsoever. And we don't scrub it or anything. We just wipe it out with a sponge. Usually the food doesn't really stick on anyways because it's nicely seasoned. You just wipe it out, dry it completely, and then spread oil on the inside.
Yeah, and then just put it on the heat. And let it be on a high heat till the oil comes to a smoke, and then take it off and let it sit. And as soon as it's cooled down, you can put it away. If you are going to put other pans inside of it, you should protect the inside with a cloth or something like that so it's not scratching the surface.
Yeah.
That's it. It's pretty easy to have cast iron and to use cast iron for cooking.
Oh, yeah.
The other benefit I want to talk about, and the reason I bought an even larger cast iron skillet set when it was on sale on Amazon. And I think they have it. I know they have the same set I bought Lodge at walmart.com, which we have the link for that on our website. But is that you can use it over campfires, which is really handy.
Mm, yeah.
If, you know, if everything did go to pot or we somehow lost
our propane.
Yeah, our propane, electricity, whatever it is that you use for cooking. Sometimes you need to cook over an open fire or cook over a barbecue.
Oh, yeah.
And you can do that really, really easily with cast iron. You don't even need to
like protect it in any way. It's really tough.
Yeah, it's meant for that. And I really like, too, that you can cook it on the stovetop and you can put the cast iron lid on and then throw it into the oven. It goes from oven to stovetop
very easily.
Around an open fire. I mean, it's very
tough.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's really heavy, too.
It is heavy, and it's versatile. So I would highly recommend it. Again, we have the link to the set that I own on our website, and I guess that's it.
Yep.
We will see you next time.